everybody, and welcome back to another Indie Corner Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I've got an awesome guest. I have this feeling like I interviewed you a long time ago, you know, during the Independent Corner radio days that I did.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah, a while back. But welcome back. Brand new show, but, you know, it's kind of similar. Justin Timpain, how you doing, Justin?
I'm great. I'm sitting here in my Christmassy house. I should have brought eggnog. I had this whole thing. I was going to drink eggnog, and now I can't go get it. But if I spot my wife coming down the stairs, if you see a lovely lady walk into frame and give me eggnog, it's because my lovely wife will maybe bring me eggnog if I ask nicely.
Text her, you know, that seems to be what everybody else did.
Oh, dude, that's a really good idea. So so for the podcast audience who don't have the benefit of the visual, Justin has picked up his phone and has started texting his wife, "Can you bring me eggnog?"
Is it going to be chunky though?
We can talk about why you're asking that question. Yeah. I have so many stories to tell.
I can't wait. Like, I'm excited. So to begin with, I just watched, and I told Justin I was watching a Christmas Cancellation, which he wrote and directed, and it's on Tubi for free. So if you guys want to go see that, it's a great Christmas movie to watch. Sadly, this will be out after Christmas.
Yeah, but it's also like an episode of the Twilight Zone. So, and yeah, it's on Tubi, it's on Amazon, it's on iTunes, anywhere you can watch it except Netflix. But other than that, find it, watch it. It's great.
It's fun. I almost don't feel like, other than the fact that it supposedly happens on Christmas or whatever, it's not really a Christmas movie, you know, or whatever. So they don't have to watch it during Christmas time.
No,
you know,
no, it can be watched during not Christmas time. However, it is as much a Christmas movie as White Christmas is.
Or Die Hard.
Or Die Hard. So I had this conversation. It's okay if I just sidebar all the time,
because sure,
this is what I do. So I'm ADD all over the place.
Me too.
I had this conversation with my wife about the whole, is Die Hard a Christmas movie question? And nobody questions that White Christmas is a Christmas movie. They go, it's like the top 10 Christmas movies all time, you know, Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, White Christmas. And I watch it every year. And it's the story of two war buddies who become like big Broadway stars and tour around and then try and save an inn, and they sing the song White Christmas, and at the very end I think it's Christmas Day, and that's it. There's nothing about Christmas. There's less about Christmas in White Christmas than there is in Die Hard, because Die Hard is a Christmas party. He's there for Christmas. He's there to see his family for Christmas. At the end, he's got Christmas wrapping things. Now I've got a machine gun. Ho, ho, ho. Nothing would be happening if it weren't a Christmas party. The entire movie is predicated on it being Christmas party. But White Christmas, I can't even tell you for sure if it's on Christmas or not, because it has that little to do with Christmas. And our movie Christmas Cancellation was originally written not as a Christmas movie. It was just called Cancellation. And then we added the Christmas bits to it, but it has actually real Christmassy themes. Santa's in it, and there's lots of eggnog, which we can talk about.
Yeah. There's lots of eggnog that Santa's in it. Well, no, I mean, it that's true though. Like I've never thought about White Christmas being so little to do with Christmas. But that's the thing. You put Christmas in the title, I guess everybody just assumes anyway it's a Christmas movie, you know?
And the title change was a last minute thing. It was called, there are posters out there for Cancellation. It was the first few awards it won, it was playing at the festivals for as Cancellation. That was a conversation we had with the distributor about changing it to Christmas Cancellation, because there's Christmas trees everywhere. I mean, Christmas does factor into it in a pretty significant way. So, so if you can call it White Christmas, this can be called Christmas Cancellation. And,
for sure.
And people do discover it. It was like, I mean, it's not like the top 10, but it was above Christmas movies that you knew last year on Amazon. Like it crept up into like the top like 30 or 40 Christmas movies last year on Amazon, which was cool.
Definitely. So when I was watching it, it's definitely more than that though. Like, the whole movie is the concept of like, and I'm guessing we're going to get into this, and we could probably get into this now.
There's the angry wife I was telling you about, who's bringing me. Hi, this is Kelly. Oh wait, step in real quick. This is executive producer, Kelly T. Payne for all of Endlight, and she is actually standing behind me in cancellation. She's the wife at the end of Ninjas vs. Zombies who summons Nosferatu.
Sorry about that.
And she is has as much to do with Endlight as me or Daniel Ross or anyone else. She does more work on it than I do sometimes. So I guess
you say sorry about that, but he's the writer. You know, you're the writer. You got to make that happen. So, you know, she says sorry, but there you go. Dad life. There you go.
Dad life.
But see, okay. So to go back to the whole story, like, you know, sets up where this, if people haven't seen it, and we're probably going to spoil a little bit of it. So sorry.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's in the trailer.
Help it. I mean, it's
the hook.
Yeah. So the whole idea is this, you know, a group of people find out that they're actually like characters in a TV show that's about to get canceled. I mean, that's pretty much the premise of the thing. So we're not really spoiling that, but like a lot of it becomes like very meta.
And, it's a movie about death.
Right.
Is what it's about. The idea for it, I wanted to do something that could almost work as a play that was in kind of one location. And that was the one thing I'm gonna do, is I'm gonna do something that was in a single location. So I started thinking about what could happen. I started thinking about things like you go, oh, how you can't do a movie in one location. I go, but you watch Friends, and Friends is like in a location for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours, and they can get stuff out of it. So and Star Trek has, you know, my favorite show, has, you know, they have what are called bottle shows, where the best episodes are just on the ship.
Right.
And so I started with that. And then I, you know, it's not a brand new idea, the idea of the fictional characters. There was a movie called Stranger Than Fiction with Will Ferrell.
Last Action Hero.
Last Action Hero. Right. The question of what is real and what is not. But I also worked for a long time with dying patients, as I worked in healthcare for a long time. And there was sort of this question that has come up. I watched come up just last week. A family member had a very good friend pass away, and it was the decision to eventually stop fighting was the decision I wanted to sort of hit at, was the decision to go, you know what? You can fight and fight and fight and fight to live, but if you do so, you might not ever actually live. You will just spend all of your time fighting. And so it's people who've reached the end of their life who've decided, I'm not doing chemo now, or I'm just going to go into hospice and I'm done fighting. And I want to sort of, I have very few days left, and I want to enjoy the days that I have. The question was, how can you work that theme into a location? That's sort of where the whole idea of, okay, well, fictional characters, you know, and what is the nature of a life? There's a line in the movie that was the if there's one of the main themes or one of the main sort of existential questions being asked by the movie, there's a single line where someone asks, we care more about fictional characters we see on TV than we do about people we actually know. Mm-hmm. So if I watch, you know, if my best friend loses his uncle, you know, I'm like, oh man, that's too bad. I feel so bad. I don't personally feel bad, but I feel bad for my friend. If I watch Buffy and Buffy loses a family member, I'm not going to say who, Buffy loses a family member.
There was a family member she lost. Yes.
I weep. I weep for this person.
That was the saddest episode, I will say.
Of television of all time.
Right.
But those people aren't real. Like the actress who played the person that she lost is still alive. So our hearts connect more deeply with fictional characters than they do with some people that we call family. So when you say that then you get to the idea of what is real and what does it mean to love something and what makes us real, but how, you know, and why aren't we real to each other? Because it's very easy to other people. So it all sort of like gets into that. And I wanted to sort of do that while also, you know, make it funny, because it's a funny movie too.
And it is, but I will have you know, on Tubi, it is classified as a drama. It does not say drama comedy. And I think that's very fair because I wouldn't want people getting their hopes up thinking this is going to be a ha 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 very funny, you know, sort of thing. It becomes dark. Like, it goes darker than I was expecting it to go. Toward the end, like, where things just go, like, I mean, at one point
I started in a horror. I can't go back. I can't not have a little bit of horror.
Right. I mean, no, there is horror. There's very horror, you know. There's an element where she's talking to people that, you know,
it's a scary scene.
It's a scary scene. And I was just like,
it happens right here behind me.
Yeah. Which is, it's just, okay. So let's talk about that real quick, because the thing is, you were just mentioning how, like, it's set basically in one location. You know, the whole fucking movie is set in one location. And that usually drives me up the wall. Like, I've been one of those people that have said, I do not like movies like that. And I didn't know, like, going into it at all, that it was just going to be one location. And so when I started watching it, I didn't even feel like this was just one location, because you utilized your whole house, basically, you know.
It's one location in filmmaking terms of having a location. It's one set. It does, in fact, take place in four different universes on that set.
Right.
So it's in, you know, it's in one location where it's a sitcom, and the aspect ratio, which is the shape of your square, is in 4x3. So it's like your old TV sets. And everything's really super bright and oversaturated. There's the same place, but it's black and white. Which is the space between realities, where only some people can exist.
I like that. Like, I like that. And you know what? I'm going to spoil it. It was the fucking bathroom, which I thought was great. I have to ask you a question though, because I was talking to somebody about this last night. Bathrooms. Did you look this up? Like, did you find out that, like, apparently family shows can't show bathrooms?
Well, they can now. They can now, but for a long time, if you go back and look at like Mary Tyler Moore and the, actually I'm thinking about the Dick Van Dyke Show in particular, where they had at one point separate beds. Beds were separate, you know, and there was and you didn't show stuff in the bathroom. It was just not something that you did. Because that was not appropriate for a family show. It's, you know, censors are weird. So especially back then in the 50s and 60s. So yeah, it's not something that you have a lot, but I mean, it's probably not 100% true. I'm sure that you could probably find one, but for the sake of the movie, it worked really, really well. The great thing is that you would walk around my house and you wouldn't understand the geography at all, because the geography of the house in the movie is totally different than the geography of my house. So doors open to rooms that are not actually there.
Nice.
Like when you're, yeah. So it's, but it's, you know, it is what it is. It's fun. We wanted to make sure that we had, you have the two other universes that take place in the same thing, right? You have a space between episodes of where everything is very, I guess you have five universes, because you have a space between episodes where everything is sort of, it's lit like a color horror movie, but all these bizarre reds and greens, like you're in a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Then you have the horror version of the world, which is just total nothingness. And then you have the quote real world, which is the set where everything is working. And the aspect ratio goes from 2.6 to 1 to 16x9, which is just the size of your computer thing. And so that, like, it really is trying to take the one set, but make it, like, you can be in the same room five times, and the five times mean different things. That makes any sense.
No, I totally, yeah.
Wow. If you see the movie, it makes sense. If you haven't seen the movie, you're like, what the hell are you talking about, Justin?
No, I get it. Exactly. Like, when I watched it, I was just like, there's just so much going on right here, you know, in this scene, you know. Hold on one second. My dogs are trying to get out real quick. My room.
He has stepped away. Now it's me. Just me on the show. Whatever will Justin do while he stepped away? No one knows. He's probably going to edit this part out. I really kind of hope he doesn't. And he's back. Shoot.
Oh, I am back.
I had so much more to say.
You're planning.
Anyway, guys, do that. And that's how you hide the bodies.
Oh, okay. Good. All right. Well, there you go. Giving some help.
Entertaining tips. And education.
Yes. There you go. So to go back. It has so many different layers to it too. Like, it's not just like you said. It was, you know, it was kind of comedy. It was dark comedy. You know.
I would call it a dramedy. I would say that it's on a scale. I'm listening to a podcast. We're talking about tone scale. It's a great podcast, but I'm not going to advertise other people's podcasts on your show, okay. But it's good. But there's a tone scale. And I think that it exists in sort of it is a drama, but with comedic elements. I think that's, I think that a comparison to Buffy would actually not be entirely inaccurate. In terms of tone, that it is all at once. It takes itself seriously, but it's funny because life is funny, and it's not funny and like here are jokes. It's because life is funny.
So was it weird for you as a writer to write these characters kind of come to life? And did you, like, at one point, like, kind of freak out yourself, like wondering, like, if by doing this, am I bringing my characters to life? Am like.
That was so if ever I were to write a sequel, because every filmmaker thinks about writing a sequel to their movie, even right. if they don't. And the sequel actually is the idea that you've put these characters in charge of the show. Oops, spoiler alert, but the show falls into the hands of not just the writer eventually. And what would happen if the characters started trying to dream up new scenarios and then they created something outside of their control? And I borrowed some. I had another script that I was going to do with my creative partner Daniel Ross. And I were thinking about a script at one point where I was going to be in it as the writer. And in that movie, it was an action comedy. In that movie, the bad guy was going to kill me halfway through the movie, and then the entire movie was going to fall off the rails.
Right.
Because
there's no writer.
There's no writer. That's the whole idea is that the movie's in charge of itself. And the whole movie is just going to be just structurally bizarre and nobody would know what to do with it. But we ended up cribbing some of the ideas into this one. So that problem will probably never get made.
Well, there you go. But I sort of like movies where they go off the rails, where you have no idea where this is going. And even this film, like, I mean, there's a structure to it, obviously, but it didn't feel like, I mean, it felt like you had no idea as an audience member what was going to happen next. And I like that, you know, because.
Well, it was, I'm a fine writer. I'm okay. But it was buoyed by both an extraordinary production team, which took very little money and took a house. And made a movie that at times looks beautiful for the budget and sounds good. And I can't say enough about our DP Tony or the other creatives on the set and the other producers. And then of course the cast who just elevate it and elevate and elevate it. And Lauren who plays B has won a couple of awards from it, which she absolutely 100% deserves. Mm-hmm. And I put my personal stamp on everything I do. So everything's like, hey, look, Justin. But truly, if you thought the writing was good, it's because half the time, because they made it sound good. So I can't give enough praise to all five of them who just knocked it out of the park. Like without a doubt, there wasn't a weak link among them. And it was an astounding experience working with them.
How long did it take to shoot?
I think we shot the whole thing. I think we had three weekends that we shot all the principal photography, and then we took a week off, and then we did another two weekends of pickups after that. So 5 weekends total, 15 days, 15 days total. But we shot most of it in 9 days, and then we had a big rewrite. I was cutting as we put it together. So by the time we got back, the movie was mostly in a rough cut. So when we got back, we could see where, we need to pick this up, pick that up here and there. And we were able to grab that, write a couple new scenes, and insert some stuff that wasn't there, pump up the laughs and the scary parts a little bit.
Yeah, that was good. I'm impressed. It was definitely a really good movie and a lot of fun. And if you ever do a sequel, I definitely want to see it, you know.
I kind of wouldn't want to ruin it. Like that's the one thing is I kind of wouldn't I'm a giant Star Wars fan. Are you a Star Wars fan?
Yeah. I mean, I'm into it. Like there are parts that I'm really into and parts that I'm not as into, you know, or whatever, but yeah. You know, that's
so I love all of it. I love Rise of Skywalker. I love Last Jedi. I love them less than other ones.
Right.
But I love them. The problem with Force Awakens, for instance, the problem with Force Awakens ends up being, and this is necessary when you do a sequel, it's the same problem that Empire Strikes Back has. If you're going to use the same characters, you have to undo their victory. Unless they're characters who are going out on further adventures like Indiana Jones or something. But if you're going to say, this movie has ended, but now we're going to put them back into trouble, then you have to go, okay, well, their happy ever after is not happy ever after because now something bigger and badder is going to get them. They have to struggle again. And I kind of don't want to make these five struggle again. Like,
right.
I want them to have their happy ending and to have it like forever. And right. I don't want them to come back and face more difficult, you know, things. I think they deserve it. And so I think that, I don't know, it would feel kind of heartless to have put them through that, you know, because the whole point was getting the happy ending, as opposed to like the Ninjas movies where the point was, okay, this adventure's done, you know. And even now I'd have a problem going back and making a fourth Ninjas for the same reason, because everybody just suffers so much in that third one that like by the time they get a happy ending at the end, I can't imagine doing more of these poor fictional people because they just, I was so mean to them. And then I gave them the nicest, like big giant smiley ending at the end of the movie. I can't imagine going back in and going, ha, psych.
Well, it would sort of be like, what is it? Marvel, you know, with Spider-Man, you know, like a lot of times they make Spider-Man suffer and yeah. everything. And then they bring him back, you know, and I think that's a lot of what's supposed to happen in this next one. I don't know.
I have my tickets for Friday afternoon. So okay. I'm going to be off the internet.
Okay. I will be too, actually, because I'll be going on at 12 o'clock on Friday. You know, myself.
I'm beyond it. There's a great meme. There's a meme that's out there that is taken from Avengers Endgame. And it says, do you think Toby and Andrew will be in this movie? And it's like, it's Black Widow asking Captain America. He has his head in his hand. And he goes, I know they will because I don't know what I'm going to do if they're not.
Aww.
Which is, it's sort of a shame because if they aren't, everyone's going to be pissed. But now, because everyone's expecting it, if they are, no one's going to be like, yay, I wasn't expecting that. So like, there's kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Yeah. I don't know how that even like became a thing where somebody found that information out, you know?
Like, I don't know. It's all a dream. I rewatched those Amazing Spider-Man movies, the Andrew Garfield ones, because we've been working. I have a 10-year-old, and so we've been working through all the old ones to get ready for this one in case, because we know it some parts of it's crossover. So we watched all of them, and they're better than I remember.
Right.
And the Amazing Spider-Man 2 is better than I remember. It's just what they did with Electro that's the real giant problem. But I will take Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy and her chemistry with Andrew Garfield any day of the week over Toby and Kirsten Dunst. They are just like every scene they have together is electric. She's great. He's, you know, I'm not slamming Toby, but he's just a better actor. So I don't think they're better than the original ones. I don't think they're better than new ones, but people hate on them. Like they're like, oh, and then there's the shitty Andrew Garfield ones. And they're not, they're fine. They're good.
I have to say a lot of people recently, I've been seeing a lot of people say that they don't even like the new MJ was Zendaya. And you know, honestly, I rewatched Far From Home the other day, and I really loved her. Like, I think she's just so like adorable.
I think problem is she's not Mary Jane. She's not anything like Mary Jane. She's called MJ, and that's where all similarities end.
Right.
With Mary Jane in the comics. And I think that people were a little put off. Frankly, I think that if they had named her Gwen, instead of MJ, if they called her Gwen, I would have been, I think that you wouldn't have the same problem you have. I love Zendaya. And I didn't get what she was doing in the first one, because she, her performance is kind of that sarcastic, understated thing that she was doing. I thought it was an acting thing that she, I thought she was like just not doing a great job in the first one. And then I saw her in The Greatest Showman, and saw that, oh, she can be very different than that. And then I went back and watched Far From Home, and I realized, oh, that was just an acting choice, and that's was deliberate, and it works. So like, that's a movie that grows on me. I love not Far From Homecoming. I love Spider-Man Homecoming. But here, now we're talking about other people's.
Well, I mean, you know, I think some, a lot of times I do that, because, you know, and it's, you know, especially if I find somebody who likes, you know, that sort of stuff, because honestly, in the indie community, there's this hatred for like, you know, Marvel or Star Wars or whatever. And I'm just like, dudes, I mean, I'm sorry, but I didn't grow up watching indie films. I ended up becoming an indie film maker myself because of circumstances and everything, you know. But had somebody when I was 20, you know, when I started directing myself, said, hey, do you want to direct a Marvel movie? I would have jumped on board. And,
I'd do it now. I would do it right now.
I'd do it right now too. You know?
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I lied. No, I would not. I would not do a big Marvel movie. But back when like Fox was putting out like little Marvel movies, like when they were doing like Daredevil and stuff, I would do a 50 millionaire.
Why wouldn't you do an MCU movie? So now we're talking about you.
Me personally.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think a lot needs to be learned by Josh Trank's experience directing that Fantastic Four reboot.
Right.
You know, where he was like, he wanted to do one thing, and they're like, well, F you, we're Marvel, so you're going to do what we say. And so you have this movie that is neither of those things, and ends up being this bizarre, like, clearly you can see the conflict. You can see what he was going for. You can see what they were going for. And you could see like one scene is from one movie and one scene seems to be from a completely different movie. And if you watch Chronicle, which is great, his first film, like, I see why they would hire him, but then they didn't let him do what he was going to do. And the MCU has been notorious for that. For
Scott Derrickson.
Yeah. Or Edgar Wright. Right.
Edgar Wright. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it takes someone who can manage that level of a machine, and someone who has more trust than I do. Maybe if I'd made a couple of regular, you know, but when you're an indie film, you know, you know this, you pick up the camera yourself,
right?
You know, you do that yourself. And the idea,
you have way more control. Yeah. Know.
And the idea of I'm turning 35% of my movie over to a second unit that it's the same people who've done all the other Marvel movies and they know how to do it. You know, that would be hard for me. And that's why I think they keep bringing indie film directors, or not, sorry, TV directors, to do it. Because if you look at, so I had this conversation with Ed Sanchez once, because he's been directing all like Supernatural and like all these, and I said, what's it like? And he said that it was like, you don't come in and tell them how to make their show. Like, right. you come in and your job is to get the best performances you can out of the actors, to get the best angles you can out of the crew, to make the crew do their best to deliver what's on the page, in the style that the show already is. And I think that's why a TV director has an easier time coming in and doing some of these Marvel things, because they can come in and they understand how to let certain things go and just focus on the things they need. But then you have things like Eternals, which again, Eternals, just like, I didn't hate it, but it just seemed like there was one movie happening that then would stop so they could have a Marvel scene and then go back to the movie that they were making. Right. And it just, I would love to do like the Batman that they're doing right now. Like, that's the sort of thing I would love to do, something that's moody and intense. And that would be fun to do, but I don't know how much fun I would have directing an Endgame and just going like, okay, we're getting the shots. We're just getting the shots, just shots. You know, I feel like it would, I don't know if I have the headspace to deal with that much.
And I see, here's the thing, like, James Gunn left Marvel and went to DC and did Suicide Squad. And it was amazing. And like, the beginning of that film was like, so like, whoa, this is so anti-Marvel, you know, yeah. like this Marvel would never let like all these characters just randomly, you know, right. Yeah. And do you watch the pitch meeting guy? The guy who does On Screen Rant, does the little no. pitch meeting. There's yeah. this guy who like, basically it's him and then it's him again. And he's pitching, you know, to the movie. You know, or whatever.
I have seen a couple of them. I haven't seen the Suicide Squad.
Right okay. Now. Well, I mean, but just like he looks at that, just he's just like, what the, wait, we did that. You want to yeah. do that? All right. You know, that's happening, you know, like, and that's gotta be what they were thinking is like, wait, you want to kill those people and everything. And that's something that, you know, the MCU just doesn't do. And that's fine because what, in my opinion, Kevin Feige is the showrunner of all, yeah, absolutely. You know, he's the one in charge of everything.
And I think you have to think of it like that, like a TV show.
Right.
He's the showrunner. And they're making huge episodes of right. this show.
Of this show, the Marvel yeah. show. Yeah. And every, you know, every episode, people come in, they direct an episode, but they're not, just like you said, Ed Sanchez just goes in there and tells them kind of what, where to aim the camera, you know, in a way. Doesn't really like, go there.
He directs the actors. He directs the actors. And that, yeah. that's that he, which is something he's very good at.
Well, Sam Raimi's been used to it. I mean, with yeah. The original Spider-Man.
But look what happened to him, right? Look what happened to him by Spider-Man 3. By Spider-Man 3, he was being told what to do. He did not want Venom. Mm-hmm. He did not want the multiple characters to all be there. They were trying to shove in all these things because of what Sony wanted him to do.
I think that's ironic because now he's doing Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. You know how many freaking characters are going to be in that movie?
and which is going to be a direct follow-up to Spider-Man.
All right. Well, there you go.
I mean, that's it. Because Doctor Strange is in Spider-Man. You got to imagine that he's coming over. Like, mm-hmm. like Doctor Strange, who he's directing, Benedict Cumberbatch, who's he's directing, is on set with Willem Dafoe in the costume that he designed. I am certain that he was on that set.
Yep. Yeah, I have a feeling too. And so yeah, I'm really excited because to see what happens tomorrow, tomorrow for Hawkeye, because I have this feeling, I have a weird feeling, I might be wrong, but I have a feeling it's going to connect, you know?
Then the Hawkeye's just going to go crazy that they're just going to like, I would love it. Wouldn't that be amazing if Hawkeye just suddenly became a different show?
Well, no, but I would love it if all of a sudden, because what people are thinking is going to happen is that basically because they take place in the same time period, I think,
yeah,
you know, or whatever, that he's just going to hear that Spider-Man is, you know, on
la 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 la.
Oh, la, you don't want to hear anything?
I don't know because I have theories as well, but one of my least favorite things is when somebody tells me what their theory is, and then I go in the movie and they're right.
And they're I'm like, right.
Ah! No.
Okay. Well, just watch Hawkeye tomorrow and then talk to me. And
I'm curious. I do think it would be very cool if suddenly like a major thing happened in that movie and there's just an episode of Hawkeye that was just about Spider-Man and then it went back to Hawkeye. Which, did you collect comics at all?
Yeah, I still do.
All right. Did you collect comics? And I mean, I don't know how old you are. You're probably younger than I am.
I'm almost 40. So
I'm 45.
Oh,
I'm an old man. Look at me. Look at how old I look. I don't look 45. In the 80s, you would have, and I guess this happened even into the 90s when you started collecting as well, you would have a massive, crossover in one of the areas of Marvel, not like the Infinity Gauntlet, which is a crossover of all of Marvel, but you'd have like, there was the Fall of the Mutants or there was Inferno, mm-hmm. right? And Inferno is a great example. I don't know if you had read Inferno at any point. It was an X-Men thing that happened. It was Inferno or Secret Wars
before. Secret Wars, yeah.
So it was its own thing. There was a Secret Wars 6-issue limited series that came out. Secret Wars 2 is what I'm thinking of, actually. Secret Wars 2 that came out. 6-issue limited series. And then in like the X-Men, it would be an X-Men comic, but in the upper right-hand corner of the comic, it would say Secret Wars 2 in the upper right-hand corner in this little triangle. And it was not a, it was not directly connected to Secret Wars, but it was the influence of Secret Wars on this comic. And they did the same thing with Inferno, where like Inferno was just an X-Men issue, but it was a huge thing that happened in New York. So there was like two issues of Spider-Man where the demons who are attacking New York for the X-Men show up. They do a thing. They actually turn Ned Leeds into, they turn Ned Leeds into like an actual goblin. Whereas before he was like wearing, like in the comics, like wearing goblin stuff. And then like the demons turn him into an actual demon. And he was like that for years. And it, but it was like, then the next issue, they sort of reference that it happened. And then they don't reference that Inferno ever happened again. And I would love if they did that on Hawkeye, where like, there's just one episode where it's like, crap, multiverse Spider-Man. And the next episode, like that was weird. And then they just go back to the show.
They just go back to the show. Well, they only have one other episode, so I don't like. That would be greater if there were like a couple more episodes, because they've got a lot to wrap up in two episodes, and it's like, you know what I mean.
I love Hawkeye.
Like,
Hawkeye is so charming, and I hope that this show. I hope the show continues forever.
Oh, I agree.
I hope they do with it what they're doing with Loki and doing another season, because I love these two together. I love Hayley Steinfeld. I want her to continue being like young Hawkeye or what she's doing, but I love them together. They are so good as sort of a friendly Batman and Robin. I'm really digging it.
We really went off the topic here.
And I know. Hey, look, guys, Marvel's fine. I'm sorry, I'm touching my mic. What else would you like to know about the wonderful Justin? Too much eggnog already.
Oh. All right, yeah. Well, at least it wasn't those spoiled eggnog, you know, or whatever, make you sick.
Okay, so yes, we talked about at the beginning of the show the spoiled eggnog in there's a point in Christmas Cancellation where there's a big punch bowl full of eggnog, and the eggnog, for reasons, spoils, and you see somebody pouring it out of the glass, and that was eggnog, banana yogurt, and gobs of cottage cheese, all swirled together till it was just this pasty clump that's just pouring out of the glass. So that is how we achieved the sour.
Did you just like mix a bunch of things to see which one would work?
Well, one, eggnog is super expensive and difficult to get at the time of year that we shot it. So we just colored milk for the eggnog itself. And then it's just, you know, you just, I start, my background is in theater. So you learn to make goopy stuff. And my wife worked very briefly for a Nickelodeon stage show for a couple of years.
Nice.
And so she knew how to make the gack.
Wait.
People.
What stage show did she work on? I know she's not here.
The King's
Dominion. Okay. Yes. I was going to say, I remember going down and like, you know, I mean, this dates me obviously, but I remember going down when I was like 10 years old or younger and seeing the set for like Clarissa Explains It All. You know,
did you ever go down to King's Dominion when they had the Nickelodeon show and the Star Trek characters were walking around? You could meet Klingons and Romulans and stuff.
I sadly did not. I've only gone to King's Dominion once in my life. And that was for a Christian rock concert thing that they were having, you know,
okay,
at the time. So I was like with some friends who went down there and did that. But I didn't even ride any of the rides.
Oh my goodness. Oh, they have the best coasters.
They're I used to work at Busch Gardens. So, you know,
I used to live in Williamsburg.
What? I live in Williamsburg still.
Right. You do? Yeah. Did you grow up there?
Yeah.
Really? Did you go to Lafayette?
Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Blair when it was a junior high school, and then it switched back to being switched to being middle school. That's when junior high schools became middle school. So I went back to Berkeley, which was my elementary school beforehand. So,
I actually went to Berkeley.
Oh, I got to know who your sixth grade teacher was.
Mr. Bruss.
Say Mr. Bruss. Mr. Yes. Bruss! I had Mr. Bruss, and he was Miss Fouts.
Miss Fouts, yep.
Oh my gosh, this is amazing.
Yes.
Did they share a room still? Did they still share
they
a room?
They did, and it was like a combined room. It was
did
like,
they still do like social lunch and stuff?
All I remember, we had to read one of my favorite things ever.
Sorry, audience. Yeah. We're just going to talk about the fact that we had the same sixth grade teacher. That's amazing.
That is amazing. I didn't even know you're from Williamsburg. That's awesome.
Here's my claim to fame, though.
Okay.
The theater program at that middle school at Berkeley Middle,
mm-hmm.
I started it.
Nice.
On my own. There was no theater program. I went to the PTA and as an eighth grader, and I petitioned, can you like start it up? I need to get signatures, and I had to get the principal to sign and all this stuff. And we put on the very first show. But I got the funding and stuff for that program to exist. So if you ever did or saw a play there.
My first show was my first play ever was this one called Hurricane Smith in the Garden of the Golden Monkey.
Yeah. Yeah, I was Hurricane Smith in Hurricane Smith in the Garden of the Golden Monkey at James Blair. That was the first play I ever did, was Hurricane Smith in the Garden.
Weird, because they did it for Berkeley. Mr. Shelley did it. I don't know
I think Mr. Shelley did it for us too at Blair when we were there. I think this is crazy. Sorry, guys, this is not an entertaining episode. Who are you in it? What year did you graduate high school?
I graduated 2000. So
2000. So you graduated 6 years after me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of anyone I knew that had what neighborhood you live in?
So there's a guy, Randall Silva, played Hurricane Smith at the time. Okay. I played Biff or whatever. I think that was his name, but I was the guy in the beginning of the thing okay. So
if you got to understand that Hurricane Smith in the Garden of the Golden Monkey is the story of like if I remember right, like this indie film pitch of an Indiana Jones ripoff.
Yeah. So it was a pitch, and so it starts off on this thing called like Big Monster on Campus or whatever.
Oh my god.
And I was the actor in a B movie, right? Basically. Yes. And I didn't know what a B movie was or whatever. I just did what they told me to do, which is what you're supposed to do as a sixth grade actor. Yeah. So I did that. And then the next year we did like one acts, right? And I did this. I was supposed to do this one act where I was supposed to play a director who got mad at all the cast members and stuff. And I came up and I freaked out because I had to like address the audience. And I had never done that before, where I'd actually gone up to like look in straight to the audience. And I freaked out and was like, I'm done with acting. So I quit for like a year. Cause I was like, I can't do this. Like, I can't, this is too much pressure and too much whatever. And
all right. I've got one for you. So I was in seventh grade. So this would be like 1988, at James Blair Middle School, or James Blair Junior High,
nice.
In Williamsburg. And I had come in as a seventh grader, and there was a guy there whose name was Robert Smith, who was an actor and who was he was kind of a big deal in here. I was this impetuous, very hyper, sort of my same personality now, but like minus any filter. I auditioned just to get out of not doing homework, and I got Hurricane Smith, and I was like, everyone was sort of pissed at me because I didn't know what I was doing, but I had all this energy. And so they liked that for the character. And so there was no understudy. And so we do Hurricane Smith, and we rehearse and we rehearse and rehearse. And the night of the dress rehearsal, I go outside and break my ankle.
Aw.
And they delay the show for a week.
For you.
I was the lead.
You're the lead. Yeah. They can't.
And the show has a lot of like jumping around and stuff.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I stay home for a week, and I'm doing like ankle exercise, like trying to do like rehab to get myself back on. And even when we do the show, I'm limping around. So I'm certain that at some point, if it was Mr. Shelley, and I think it was, at some point he probably said to the cast, everyone be careful, because we can't have anyone breaking an ankle, because this is probably the next time he did that show.
That's funny. I don't remember that necessarily. I don't remember anything except being in it, you know, and the part, you know, or whatever. Stories. But aside from that, I don't remember like, you know, anything else. Like my sixth grade years and my middle school years were like literally my worst years of my life.
Yeah, they weren't super fun. My buddy Steve. So I lived in, there was this tiny little neighborhood called Indigo Park, which is where I lived, which is across the street from what is now Williamsburg Crossing.
My friend Matt used to live there, you know, so I used to go there all the time.
I gotta know, did he have older siblings?
Because yes, he did.
What was Matt's last name? I just got into. Are you allowed to say it? Can you say it? I want to know.
I guess I'll say it. Fuck it. You know, Matt's still friends with me, so whatever. Okay. Ferraro.
I don't know Matt Ferrara, but if his last name was Welch or Headley, I would have known.
No,
because they were all the swim team kids. Because in Williamsburg, everyone has to be on a swim team. There's no like you; it's just required.
Well, my siblings were. I was not. I was a karate guy. I did karate at the rec center. So
see, I want to talk to you. So we need to go back to talking about entertainment. So I'm going to talk to you offline to find out if you have older siblings who I might have gone to school with. Which is crazy.
Okay. Yep.
Class of 94 was me. So
yeah, we'll talk. Wild. We'll talk.
I don't know if you're going to keep any of this, but I hope you do.
I might keep all of it because like, fuck
it. It's just ridiculously fun.
I know. It's just weird. Like I've never interviewed somebody. Same
sixth grade teacher. And
teachers.
Teachers. Yes. Cause they work together. And Mr. Bruss would absolutely not have forgotten me. I almost got the nurse fired from the school.
I don't think
retired. I think he just retired. Cause
again, that Google sucks.
People. You Google people. I think he just retired. He's still alive though. He's still alive, which is like, he would be pretty good. I don't think Miss Fowler, I would be very surprised.
You went to Lafayette though, right?
No, I moved to Montgomery County, Maryland.
Oh, okay.
To Gaithersburg. In ninth grade. So I took off at that point. So I never got to Lafayette, but I did 3 years, And I went to Busch Gardens until I was kicked out for stealing.
Interestingly enough, like there's more than, there's more like schools now, you know, there's not just Lafayette, there's Jamestown, War Hill. I guess
that would happen. Yeah, the population would have grown. Yeah,
War Hill, couple other like you know I think Bruton, you know, I'm sure that Bruton was around
there.
Then
Bruton was there. Oh my gosh, we take a screenshot of this and somehow get it to Mr. Bruss.
I would love that. I did not know. I'm glad I know Miss Fouts unfortunately passed away. I know that.
Yeah, she was pretty old then. She was considerably younger than he was at that point,
right?
And her weight fluctuated a lot. She'd be really big and then she'd lose a lot. She'd get big again, then she'd lose a lot. Cause we would check in. My buddy Steve lived in First Colony and I would go back and visit. So I would be back and see from time to time.
Did
so,
you ever have Mr. Lin as your gym teacher?
I don't remember my gym teachers. Okay. I was so theater. So I can tell you I had Miss Parker as my choir teacher.
Oh, okay. I never have a choir at all because I cannot sing. You can sing, and we'll talk right about that now. Let's go into that. So you're singing.
So we're just skipping ninjas. There's no time for ninjas. I made some ninjas movies.
Well, like, no, I mean, we can talk a little bit about ninjas in a second. No, I definitely want to talk about your music real quick. What would you classify it as? Because it's got a lot of punk and it's got a lot of, it almost has like a musical vibe to it.
A very good friend of mine who is an associate producer on Monsters, who I sent a copy to and who listened and said, Justin, this, because I've always said I wanted to make a musical because I'm sort of uniquely qualified to do so, and that I can both make movies and I've scored movies. I scored, I guess maybe I'll give you a little history. For those who don't know me, there was a filmmaker in Baltimore a long time ago named Don Doler. And Don Doler was in Maryland. He unfortunately passed away like 10 years ago, but he is like Maryland famous. And then he's famous among really low budget horror movie directors. They all kind of like know who he is. He had a movie called Night Beast, a movie called Galaxy Invader, and a movie called The Alien Factor.
Those like sound like movies we need on Indie Film Cafe.
They're classic. And he made it in a time like when John Waters was making his first films up in Baltimore. And so he knew John and there are actors who jump between, like George Dover jumps between one and the other. But Don, not everybody could do that like they can now. So even though Don's films were clearly cheap and clearly made for nothing, if you could complete it, you could get it on UHF channels all across the country. So he actually did. He actually managed to get quite a following. He launched the career of J.J. Abrams. J.J. Abrams scored one of the films, and he had a magazine that a lot of people launched. It was a movie made about him after he died called Blood, Boobs, and Beast.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
Yeah, well, that's about him. That's all about.
Oh, wow, that's
Don.
Okay.
Don is the subject of that film. And that film was shot when he was making a movie called Dead Hunt. He made a movie before Dead Hunt that just came out like 10 years later called Crawler. And Crawler, I played the lead in Crawler. And then the second lead is a guy named Daniel Ross, who I met.
Love there. Daniel. Daniel's yeah, a well, good that, dude.
That's where we met. That's where Daniel and I met, is doing Crawler. And we played best friends in the movie, and we've remained best friends ever since.
Nice.
I'm going to see him in like 5 days.
Tell him I said hey.
I will. I mean, he's family, though. He's like he, whenever he comes, he stays here and we hang out. We stay up way too late. And so he lived in Frederick. I lived in Montgomery Village at the time in Gaithersburg. And so the way we became best friends is we carpooled back and forth to set. We just spent like an hour and a half each way, like 20 times. And so I threw my hat in the ring, having dabbled in it before in college, to score Crawler. I said, here's what I think I can do. And they let me do it. And so I scored Crawler, and there was a song on that. And then when Dead Hunt came out, I got cast as the killer in Dead Hunt. And I said, well, hey, do you want me to score it again? They're like, sure. I said, I'll do it for free. So I scored those two movies. And ever since then, I was like, I want to make a musical. Cause I started recording songs when I was like in sixth grade, and they started sounding like kind of good by the
time. Did you ever show Mr. Bruss?
Mr. Bruss would not have been aware. So he would have known that there's, again, we just get back. There is a Williamsburg famous band called the Smith Wade Band.
Yes. I love this. I love Cabot. Like he's so just,
Cabot, yeah. Cabot was my guitar teacher.
Oh, that's awesome. John and I grew up together. John Wade, his son.
John would know who I am.
Yeah.
Cause he lived in Indigo Park.
Yeah,
he's a good dude. Are there any other kids? It's just John, right? Just the
I think he had a brother named Jason, if I'm right.
Jason's the one that I knew. Okay. Jason was the one that I knew. Wow, this is bizarre.
Yeah.
And so Cap was my guitar teacher. They did a talent show at Berkeley in sixth grade, and I won it.
Nice.
I sang Faith by George Michael. Up on stage with a guitar in an all white outfit.
So Limp Bizkit stole from you.
Yes, totally. No, it wasn't that version. With a very conservative young man who I've remained friends with, named Blake Keller. Hi, Blake, if you ever see this, who was supposed to do the lights for me, but then his parents realized that we were singing a song. We're sixth graders. We're singing, I think it would be nice if I could touch your body. And they didn't let him do it.
Yeah, probably not.
So that was sort of my, well, and that was an important day for me because I was not a popular kid. I was a weird kid. I was made fun of. I had bullies, all that stuff. It was tough. But I realized that I could sing and I could perform, and those same bullies would be in the audience clapping for me.
Right.
And then they'd punch me in the arm again the next day. Right. But if I could get myself on stage, I was good enough that I actually had in high school, someone come up to me while I was playing piano. Her name was, I'm not going to say her name. Because I actually still know her. She came up to me and she goes, Justin, I want you to know, I don't like you. I said, thank you. She goes, but I respect your talent.
Aww.
And I didn't know what to do with that. I was like, okay, I prefer you like me of the two, if I could choose. But so I think that it was sort of it was a safety net where I'm like, okay, I know I can do this. And so whatever my personal shortcomings are, I can put them aside and I can impress people if I can't get them to like me. So it sort of started there. But yeah, Mr. Bruss would absolutely remember that talent show, as would everybody. So I started recording, and then as soon as you could do it on a computer, like in like 96, I started recording on a computer when I stopped using a 4-track. And then I put out an album or two while I was in college. And then I started submitting songs, and I got a couple that got a little bit of notice with other people singing them for events. Like I had a song called Long Way Home in Richmond that kept getting performed for these things. I never sang it, but it was like other people would go sing it. And that was neat. And I took a break and I became the movies guy. I became the ninjas guy. And I was always like, I want to go back to, because my first love, I was going to be a music major. I went to St. Mary's College in Maryland, and I was one of those people who was like, I was arguably the best male singer in my high school at one point. And it's very much an Al Bundy situation where you're like, I am hot. Can I curse at all? Is that okay?
I think we've been cursing all night. So it's okay.
All right, so I was like, I am hot shit. Look at me. I am the best singer at Quince Orchard High School. There are people who disagree with me, but I thought I was the best singer at Quince Orchard High School. I've got it made. I'm going to Broadway. And then I went to St. Mary's. I got into their vocal program. I was like, yay. And then I heard all the other freshman guys. And I was like, crap. And I realized on that day, I was never, ever, if I worked every moment of my life as hard as I could, I was never going to touch them. I was never going to be in an audition where they were and get the role, because I was high school good, but I wasn't professional good when it came to being a singer, which is all I ever wanted to be. And so being able to come back and write my own music and do it my own way is, I'm a good writer too. So I can like work those two together to hide the fact that I never became the huge singer that I thought that I was going to be one day. I think that happens to everyone. I think everybody, you know, certainly there are plenty of like high school quarterbacks that then get to college and they're like, oh no, wait, hold on. But that's sort of what led me to go into doing theatrical stuff professionally and being an actor instead of a singer when I finally started doing it for money. So doing the album was big for me. It was a huge deal.
Well, you know what? I believe that shows a lot of humility too, you know, on your behalf, whether or not you meant that or not.
It was forced upon me.
Well, I mean, but it was sort of like, it's a really good thing, because like there would still be a lot of people who think, well, I'm still hot shit, fuck these guys. And then they don't realize there. I'm not going to say his name, but there is a guy, he's a filmmaker and he's just not good. You know, and he won't listen to anybody tell him, you know, I can talk to you afterwards and tell you more, but he won't listen to anybody when people give him critique. You know, he surrounds himself with people who give him all yes, you know, yes, this, yes, that. And he's a rapper. And
you're not talking about me, are you?
No. Do you rap? I don't really remember any
on the album. There's a rap song on the album.
No,
called The Grumman.
Oh crap! I think I heard that, but
the guy, let's call him Grumman. Yeah.
Okay. But it's not you. Okay. Trust me. No,
I'm always scared I'm getting in trouble.
But no, you're a way better filmmaker, because and I believe you probably surround yourself with people who tell you, okay, that's not a good idea. You shouldn't do that. You know.
I don't mean to. I'd love to surround myself with yes people. I've not found them. I still think that I've got the best idea, but it's, you know, I think it comes from back to that girl at the piano. Like it was, I always see myself as like the kid who's just sort of lucky to be there.
Right.
And so it's, and I let people pick on me because I draw it to myself anyway, because I'm sort of, have you been talking to me? Audience, you've been listening to me for an hour. You want to make fun of me because I never shut the F up.
Neither do I. So we've got that in common.
And so I always want to grab the reins. And in Ninjas vs. Zombies, the reason Ninjas vs. Zombies is the worst film that I made, even though I love it, is because I did everything. I made everybody say every word exactly the way I wanted. I didn't take notes on the script. There are places where I thought things were funny that they weren't. And it wasn't until we got to Vampires that I was like, okay, I'm going to trust you guys to do stuff, where I realized that like in film, you need to delegate to people who have more expertise than you. Mm-hmm. And as an indie film director, I can do almost everything in film, from writing to directing, to acting, to doing the music. I can do it all pretty well.
Right.
I think a good indie director needs to be able to do it all pretty well, so that they can then collect and recognize people who can do it really well, and then have the humility, which I didn't learn until Monsters, and that also stretched into Cancellation, to be able to go, okay, I'm good enough to know that you're better than me, so go do it. That's necessary. So it's, you know, I'm like a Swiss Army knife of skills, in that I'm good to have around if you need someone to do a thing, but I'm never the thing you would choose to have. You know, you don't want to use my Phillips head screwdriver. I can do it, but let's find someone who can do it better. And I think that is sort of, you know, when I, if, as I watch my movies improve, very little of it has to do with, I mean, yes, I'm more comfortable on a set than I am the first time, and I know my way around and what to do now, but it's mostly being able to go, I recognize where the talent lies, and I let them do what they do, because they, you know, I am not a director of photography. I think I am, but I'm not. And so if I get someone like Tony, Antonia Perry, by the way, who was just a, or Sel, as she goes by sometimes, just, I would be an idiot to go, no, I think the light should be like this. No, step back and let her do her work, because she's going to do better than I am. So,
you know what? I think I felt that way too in the beginning. You know, I think I tried to force myself more control, you know, because I felt that that was what a director was supposed to do. You know, I felt like a director, especially if you've written the movie and you are producing, that you are supposed to be the one who tells everybody what to do all the time. It wasn't until I was on a set and I was trying to do all that, and I had an AD. I'll never forget this. The AD came up to me. And God bless her. She came up to me and she was like, Jonathan, you need to go talk to those actors over there and just relax and let me handle everything else, you know, over here, you know, and that stuff. And I was just like, what? Wait, what? Like, I'm so used to just going over and doing this and that. Now you're, you know, it's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, it is. It was very hard the first. I mean, Monsters was. I mean, you've seen Monsters, right?
I've seen Vampires. I'm not sure if I got a chance to see Monsters. I think I did because I think I rented
Monsters
it
is the only one that's hard. Yeah. Well, no, Vampires was on Netflix. Monsters had a very difficult release, so it can only be found on Vudu. It's the only place where it is. It's a long story.
Okay.
I can't get into it. I'm not allowed to talk about it all that much. Okay. But. It was an enormous production. There were like 100 extras and like 5 makeup people. And like, we had 6 cameras running at one point, and just like there was so much going on, and I was going to have a nervous breakdown. And I eventually had the same thing where my crew, I didn't have a designated AD. I had a couple people who were ADs, and I had kind of, so what my wife called her, my set wife, whose name was Liz, who just like smacked me into shape.
Was that was
like,
Liz no. Christmas or?
No, that wasn't. No, that wasn't Liz Christmas. That
okay.
Was, by the way, Liz will kill me for saying this. Her middle name is Christmas.
Right.
Her last name is not actually Christmas.
Right. I assumed that.
She was trying to come up with her stage name. And I told her it should be Liz Christmas.
Nice.
So I might be responsible for Liz Christmas being called Liz Christmas. I just want to put it out there.
I just always love that. When I saw that name, I was like, wait, what?
She's like, so that's good. Awesome. And as a side note, I have not seen what she was doing, but Daniel, who was here, said that she's doing voice acting. Yes, I did.
Oh, hear. Nice.
And evidently she's having enormous success. Like, she's doing really, really well at it. So I was really pleased. Anyway, sorry, another side.
No, it's fine, because I wanted to know that, because I hadn't seen. I think I used to be friends with her on Facebook, and then did she delete her Facebook or something? I don't know.
She's not active. If she didn't delete it, she's not active on there at all.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, the album. Remember that when we talked?
Yeah,
about
we were kind of talking about that. I think
two years ago.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have had cause in the last year to talk to a lot of people who went through childhood trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have some childhood trauma, and some people have really extraordinarily, extraordinarily bad childhood trauma. And I got a chance to talk to a bunch of people about it. And what it does to you, what it does to you as an adult. And so I sort of crafted a narrative. There is a narrative within the album. The album's called Hers. It tells the story of a hypothetical teenage girl who starts off thinking that she's, you know, that she's like a bad girl because she like smoke, you know, sneak cigarettes and stuff like this. When really she's just like a normal kid, but she's, you know, just doing like display behavior that middle schoolers do. And unfortunately, as happens sometimes in those situations, finds herself with a crowd that pulls her into some really dark places, where as often happens with these sort of crowds, the ringleader is not a child, and that ringleader, and it's a conglomeration of a bunch of different stories that I've heard, but there are some themes that seem to recur and some events that seem to recur, and that's one of them. Nice. And so the story brings you, the listener, are either in one of two points of view. You're either in you're either in the point of view of her, or you're in the point of view of a friend, or it could be a redeemed family member, or it could be a future partner or something. There's a second character in there who's always sort of tracking where the first character is. And so it's always either in her point of view where she's like, I'm falling away from myself. There's nothing of me left. Or it's in a second person point of view where it's like, I'm mad that you were in this bad situation, or I'm going to be there for you. And it's outside of its context, it plays and I'll talk about the genres on it and stuff, but it plays as a collection of songs like any album would. But in its context, there's definitely value to listening to it from the beginning to the end, because it starts off in an innocently, ha ha, look at how bad I am place, goes very dark, and then comes out incredibly positive on the other end. And so that it's meant to tell that story.
You know, it has a very rock opera feel to it. And I really like that. Like it kind of reminded me a little bit of like, Pink Floyd's The Wall, you know,
Or Tommy, or the Who's Tommy.
Or Tommy, or the Who's Tommy.
Yeah, Tommy. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that, where it's like, you know, I guess, following this person and everything. And then like I said, it feels like it could have been like a musical. You know,
well, and that's and I don't know if I'd make this into a musical, because it's been emotionally taxing to be in this place for as long as I had to be to produce it. It's an emotional album. So if I made a musical, it'd probably be a little lighter than this, but as a dry run, this certainly works for me. You asked the genre of the album, and I would say, well, it's like a 90s pop punk 80s power ballad, industrial, gangster rap, waltz. Waltz sounds like a song that sounds like a carousel going round and round with calliope music, piano, yeah, ballad, bare naked ladies, inspirational
shit.
Ben Folds, jazzy rock, Taylor Swifty pop, Billy Joel ballad album.
So that's how you market it?
No, yeah, I know. It's branding has never been my thing. I'm a huge Beatles fan. I was a Beatles fan my whole life. My dad was playing Rubber Soul when I was two. Nowhere Man is one of the first three songs I ever learned. And one of the things I always really respect about the Beatles is that you can't say that they're a particular genre. Like, put on Sgt. Pepper's and tell me the genre of that album, because it's oh, look, this song's orchestral, sure, fine, yeah, this one's just blaring electric guitars, fine, it's you know, so it's, I've always respected, and Bare Naked Ladies is my favorite band, and while their radio songs all sound the same, I defy you to go listen to their album
so that was actually the funniest thing, is I remember with my sister and I were chatting once, and we were talking about a Bare Naked Ladies when it first came out, you know, right?
Yeah.
And I was just like, my sister bought it for the one week, you know, song or whatever.
That's actually the fourth album.
Okay, so yeah, that was the one that got famous, I guess, got them like sort of famous.
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, so, I mean, 1 week is it, what is it? It's 1 week. What 1 week? Pinch Me and the Big Bang Theory theme, and a lot of people only know those things, and I guess The Old Apartment, which came out beforehand, but
there's another one.
If I had $1 million was on their first album.
No, wasn't there another one? Maybe I'm thinking of another band.
Brian Wilson is a big one. It was on the radio. Pinch Me is like a dream you try to remember, but it's gone. Then you try to scream, but it only comes out.
You're going to make me like go crazy. There's a specific one that I'm thinking of right now that came out like right after, but I'm trying to think if maybe that was another band that I'm thinking of.
I've been pleased enough to have met half of the band, and I've seen them in concert 18 times. And then Stephen Page left the band, and then I've seen him in concert as well. Cause I used to pay to be in their fan club back when that was a thing. I like had to send out for it. They sent me stuff. Yeah. It's ridiculous. But like any good band, all their best stuff is not the stuff you heard on the radio.
Okay. It's All Been Done was the other one I was thinking of.
It's so good. So good. But if you listen to Stunt even, or they have another album that came out after called Everything to Everyone, where it's just like, what genre is it? Country?
Right.
There's a hip hop element to it. Why is this song being played on accordion? It's now they're doing a kids album and a Christmas album. Paul McCartney once was asked what band was doing what the Beatles did. And he said, Bare Naked Ladies.
Nice.
Because they're just making their music and wherever they get placed, I guess they get placed, but this album certainly does not have, there are some songs that sound the same between each other, but there's a certain Justin-ness to it, I guess you could say, but it's all over the place genre wise because
it's definitely, well, you said Justin, you know what you said you got ADHD. It works. Well, do you think that's sometimes a killer for some bands to have songs that like will have radio play and then the other songs sound nothing like them, and then they, you know, cause then after a while you don't hear like you know, most record executives want you to play hits, you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, like, so right, like okay, I think a great example is Goo Goo Dolls, who I'm not a fan of. I don't like the Goo Goo Dolls. I've never listened to the Goo Goo Dolls.
They're the first concert I went to.
I know enough about the Goo Goo Dolls, though, to know that everyone knows the song Iris,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't want the world to see me. That one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds nothing like the rest of their music. And it
at Black Balloon Makes Her Cry, you know, all that stuff.
It was a song they did in a different style for shits and giggles. They're like, hey, let's do this. This sounds good. Let's do it. It's not what we're used to. And it's the one that is the hit. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's frustrating for bands because that happens all the time. You know, like every time Beck puts out a song that sounds like Loser, you go, oh, that must be, no, Beck's not like that. That's not what Beck said. So there's a sound that is expected. And on their latest album, the new Bare Naked Ladies album, they came out, they have a great song that's about being small. Cause I saw them when they were an indie band at like the 930 Club, like when like nobody knew them. They're just a Canadian band turning into a giant mega hit band and then losing that fame and going back to being a relative indie band again. There's a song on their new album that's about that. And it's true. I think I don't know that it's that they just want you to play the hits, but so often the hit from the band is the one song that's different from everything else that the band does. And so, you know, I think that's fair, but I mean, look, you're an indie filmmaker. I'm an indie filmmaker. We all know that the likelihood of any of us paying our mortgage with this is fairly low. You know, it's going to be hard to reach that point where we're like, hey, this is pulling enough. You know, this movie's doing enough for me to, maybe we all have the dream. We all have the hope and it does happen. Right.
Like, and you look at Paranormal Activity or Blair Witch
Witch or Clerks. Well, right.
Okay. I want to say Blair Witch, but you know, Eduardo Sanchez and you know, the pain and struggle that dude probably went with after Blair Witch, because I think everybody was expecting him to blow up and become this, you know, these guys to become this big, huge, you know, indie sensation. And unfortunately, it really, like, that movie got famous, but they didn't get famous, you know, really.
Well, I don't know Daniel at all. Daniel Myrick, who's the other co-director. I don't know him at all. I've said hello to him on Facebook once or twice. but I know Ed fairly well. I mean, I don't want to say that we're best friends right now. And I don't think he would love that I throw around his name, because I don't want to do that. I want to respect his space. But I, to his credit, he has worked a ton. If you watch Supernatural, he did a shitload.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite shows too. So I used to see his name pop up all the time, and
yeah, and so
made me happy.
Like, and he made, you know, I like all of his movies, some more than others. He made a movie called Lovely Molly, which was not scary as much as it was disturbing.
Oh, and God, he did do Lovely Molly, didn't he?
And it was an upsetting film, and I liked it for that. It had a goal. It accomplished that goal. And it wasn't quite my cup of tea personally, but it was just so beautifully and artfully made. And then he did this little sort of semi-found footage film called Exists.
The Bigfoot. Yeah.
I don't know why that movie wasn't a giant hit. That movie was, I've seen that probably 10 times. That movie was spectacularly done. And it's the best Bigfoot movie I have ever seen. So he's done good work. And I think Altered got some, a movie called Altered that I think did fairly well, and got some notice as well. But again, I mean, it's not my place at all. Like, again, I am not the, like, I get nervous talking. I don't want to speak for him in any way. Cause again, nope. we are friends, but
that's where the line draws.
Yeah, I'm gonna stop there. I'm gonna stop and just say that you know what I will say about Ed? I will say one more thing about that. He shepherded the Ninjas trilogy. He saw us when we were nobody. We cold called him. We said, can we go to lunch with you? He says, will you buy me a margarita? I said, yes. And we went to lunch. And Jamie Nash, who is his sometime writing partner, also shepherded us. He produced it. He's producing, my friends Jay and Devin have a short film series right now called Ithaca.
I love Ithaca.
Gorgeous. Well, and they started in Ninjas. They were the main characters of Ninjas
versus. I love Jay, you know.
And Ed is shepherding their stuff right now, and it's gorgeous, by the way. Jay is you know, I was so pissed off when I say I saw Ithaca, because I was like, damn it, how did you do that?
See, I discovered Jay and Devin and Daniel and everybody from the Ninja movies, you know, or whatever, from at least Ninjas versus Vampires, which I know I've seen, because I thought, like, what in the world is this? And I had to watch it, you know.
Well, and they're so I want to know how Devin got cast. I'll tell you how Devin got cast if you'd like to know.
Sure.
So Devin gets cast in Ninjas. I mean, Jay knocked out. I mean, you should, and it, like, from moment one, walks in and just owns what he has going on. We had a lot of very talented actresses come in and audition for Alex, because he was playing Aaron and she was playing Alex. And we were really between a few people. And I went back and I watched the tapes as they were doing it. And her character, the scene they have that is a funny scene where she has a curse on her that she can't remember anything about vampires. So if you say vampires, 2 seconds later, it's out of her head. It's like, you didn't say it. It's a hilarious scene. And she was the only one in the audition who, because there were long swaths of it where she wasn't talking. And you would see in her head, you would watch her forget. You would watch just in her, she didn't overplay it. It wasn't big. But you see this moment of, like, her eyebrows would furrow and she would look around and you see her, like, trying to catch up to the conversation. And she was just so present. And it just blew me, it blew me the hell away. Like that she didn't draw attention to it. And if I hadn't been looking closely, I would have missed it. I would have missed this little, and for goodness sake, they both are even better. Jay gives a heartbreaking performance in Monsters. And Devin becomes a full on action heroine. And by the way, Jay could kick your ass. Jay is just, like, Krav Maga and stuff. He's
I don't doubt that.
He's not one to be messed with.
I wouldn't mess with him in a second. Yeah.
But I'm jealous of him, because he did photograph a lot of Ithaca, and he wrote it. He acts in it. He plays music. He wrote the music for it. Like, he's, you know, he's an impressive, I want to call him a young man, because he was young when I met him. He's an impressive man.
Impressive young man.
who I'm proud to call them friends and family.
Oh, they're sweet. And I've been friends with them and always chatting with them every now and then, you know, catching up on them. And I like to see the stuff that they're doing. And so they've been promoting Ithaca and I've just been going, okay, I got, you know, and
he also has this thing where he like paints these paintings and then shoots them.
I have one
of the Joker upstairs. It's really cool.
Yeah, I gotta check out some of his drawings and stuff, or his art.
Jonathan, you know what I am, and what I'm lucky to be, I am a fan.
Right.
Like in general, in my nature, it's in my nature to be a fan.
Me too.
Of things. I'm a fan of things. We talked earlier about Marvel. And about how some indie film director is like, oh, I don't like it. And I can go, I like all of Star Wars. I like all of Star Trek. I like Star Trek Enterprise, even though I know it's not good. I watched it. I was part of the letter writing campaign to try to save it, even though I knew it wasn't that good. I'm a fan of stuff. And through the you know, you heard what I said about the cancellation. Of course, there's a film I did with Daniel, a short film called The Distanced. Early this year, where I met this wonderful actress named Maureen, who's also astounding. And then the people in the Ninjas movies are not only like family to me, like they come up, we have reunions. We all hang out together. My wife called Devin like 3 days ago. Nice. And I called Daniel yesterday. Like it's that frequent. But I'm such a fan of these people and their work. So it was easy for me to delegate to them eventually, because I'm just like, I'm a fan of theirs. And that's what I felt when I met Ed. I was a fan of his, and I'm a fan of Daniel, even though I see all the, I know shit I can't even talk about, but I'm still a fan.
I think that's why you make a good podcaster too, you know, because like to honestly be a podcaster, you have to be a fan of the person you're interviewing generally, you know, and I'm a fan of yours.
Nobody. So on the podcast, you can hear me do. I'm actually literally doing this weird little dance.
Good. Good. But like, that's the thing. Like, you have to be sort of. We just put out one of my old interviews that I did when I first started doing podcasting back in 2006 and 7 and stuff. And God, I sucked. I was terrible. You know, but what I wanted to do with podcasting was, I was a fan of a lot of filmmakers out there, and I wanted to talk to them and to get them on. And I got Adam Green on my show before he was Adam Green. You know, he had just put out Hatchet and Spiral at basically the same time. So I didn't even get a chance. I didn't even watch them, but I just knew all of, you know, sort of knew about him and everything. But it was a terrible interview. Because now, if I interviewed him, I know everything, way too much, probably, you know, and I'd probably sound really, like, I sounded really creepy talking to Jason Mewes
once. Oh my gosh. I got Jason. So I wish I could say I knew those guys. I'm happy to be sideways connected to them, because one of our associate producers, I think got married by Kevin Smith at one point, a guy named Gavin. But he's always like showing up there and knows them and goes into the secret stash wearing Ninjas versus Zombies t-shirts.
Nice.
So when I met Ming Chen, I was wearing a Ninjas versus Zombies. He goes, oh, hey, Ninjas versus Zombies. I was like, yeah, actually I'm the guy who wrote, directed. He goes, yeah, I've seen a lot of that. He didn't say he saw it, but he's seen of it. So he's seen probably Gavin coming and wearing the shirt for him. but I was, promoting, I think, Vampires at a convention, and I had to get like food for the person who was there with me, and I went to the local Walmart next to where the convention was. I think it was like Connecticut, and there was Jason Mewes, and I don't remember the guy's name, the guy who played Jason Voorhees in the Friday the 13th reboot. Is a big tall bald dude, and he's been in other stuff as like enforcers and stuff. He's basically a stuntman. And they were both, one was there promoting one thing and Jay was there being Jay. And they were walking around Walmart and I was like, holy crap, Jason Mewes. And I said, listen, I'm really sorry. Hi, other guy. But will you call my wife? So he did. He grabbed my phone. He was like, hey. She's Kelly. Is this Kelly? She was like, yeah. He goes, hey, Kelly, can I F you?
Nice.
And she just fell. She goes, is this Jason Mewes?
She knew from his voice. That's awesome.
Oh, immediately, there aren't a lot of raspy voice dudes who call our house, I think, to ask if he can F my wife.
Right.
But she immediately knew that, okay, that's what super, again, sweetest, like the sweetest can be the brief interaction I got to have with him was wonderful. But that's my only Jason Mewes. You got to interview him?
No, sadly I didn't. I wanted to so badly. We were going to. I mean, I talked to him about it, but like my creepy thing was I walked up to him and he was on the texting his wife, you know, at the time. And wishing her a happy birthday, you know, at the time at the thing. So he was taking the time, and so I walked up to say hello, and I was going to ask him if I could interview him. So I walked up to him, and he looks up and goes, oh, sorry, I was texting my wife. I was like, how's Jordan doing? And he was like, oh, she's doing great. And I was like thinking, oh my God, I'm such a fucking...
I pulled out the J card.
Like, I shouldn't have like brought up his wife's name, like as if
my
I...
My name, yeah.
Like, yeah, I knew her.
You could just see shields up.
Like how the fuck does this guy do? But like he wasn't like, you know, because
Jordan, I'm sure... I've done business with Jordan once or twice.
Oh, nice.
And she's super sweet.
She's super really sweet. Been a big, because I'm a huge Kevin Smith fan. And yeah, so there was a time where there was like a dark place in the Views universe where they're just like, there was, it felt like hopeless lost. And there's this like, you know,
like right. Post Modcastle closing. Right. Like right that.
It was, I think it was right before it was right. After Red State. And then after like Cop Out just dark place where Kevin just almost didn't do anything. And then all of a sudden Tusk, like just gave him that love again. And everything, and that inspired him.
I remember the episode of Smodcast when they were talking about that.
That's
watching it develop into the movie is, and that's, you know, maybe that's why you podcast. Smodcast is the reason that I podcast.
Actually, it's funny. It wasn't like I got into it before he got into it. So he got into it in 2010, I think. And I was into it in 2006, and I was just, I didn't even originally want to be a podcaster. Like I just did this for fun, you know, and then I kind of kept doing it because I enjoyed doing it. And then, you know, and now it's more, even more fun, you know?
I would love to sit down with Kevin just for like an hour. Like I would give almost anything just sit
I've
down.
I've met him twice.
I've met him.
Yeah.
And I've met him. I've corresponded with him. But you know, I'm super aware of the fact that like I'm one of like 1,000 fanboys that day that did so.
And right.
I would just love an hour of his time just to like hang with him, just to be like here, let me have a beer. You have a joint and I'll have a beer and we'll chill out together and just talk. I would dig that in such a huge way.
I'll tell you some more stuff later that I can't say on here. But after the show, which we'll be wrapping up in a second anyway, but I'll give you some information that I think will blow your mind, you know, because I didn't know you were a Kevin Smith fan, but now.
Oh,
you know.
Dude, I have three different Jane Silent Bob toys upstairs, and we're literally half like almost done watching Reboot. Nice. We were watching Reboot this morning. So,
but you never seen it before, or?
No, I've seen like my fifth. I saw it when saw it when it was touring, when it was doing like the one night in theaters.
Yeah, nice. Well, all right. Well, anyway, well, thank you so much.
I got a movie's like, hat.
Yeah. I've got a movie shirt somewhere. You know,
you're a fun employee.
Yeah. but thank you so much. This has been awesome. Like, we're gonna have to get you like a year, not this come this coming year, but the next one, we'll have to get you back on Indie Film Cafe Spotlight to talk more about the ninjas stuff. And
I would love to. This has been so like, who knew that we had the same teacher? We just talked about that for a half hour.
I know, right?
What are the odds?
I don't know. It's weird. I didn't even know you were from Williamsburg. So that just made me my day.
So what was I just got to know what neighborhood did you live in while you were there?
I don't want to say because I still
struggle. Oh, you still live in the neighborhood. I'm sorry. No, I mean, oops.
I'll let you know when I'm off of here. I just don't want to like give too much information away.
If you were my neighbor, if you lived on Leon Drive, I'm going to be very upset.
No, I didn't live in Indigo Park. That's all I can say.
Okay, good. That works out. It's a very, it's a smaller neighborhood than I remember. When I was a kid, I thought it was a big neighborhood. And I went back to it. I was like, this is a tiny, tiny, tiny
little. Oh, it's always been tiny.
But at the time, you to quote the Matrix, you accept the world with which you are presented.
Yes.
Okay. So, hey, audience, the album is called Hers. And when this is done, by the time this comes out, because it comes out on December 21st. So this will probably be like, it'll probably be like very fresh when you hear this. So it's going to be on Spotify. It's going to be Apple Music, Amazon, YouTube. It's
we'll on have one a link version. For it.
Yeah, it's gonna be everywhere, and you can listen to it for free because you can just stream it wherever you stream. But it's I just want people to hear it. I don't care about making money from it. I'm sure that I will make some. I will probably make less than I spent on it. But what I want is for people to hear it and experience and have the emotional journey of I want them to go on that journey with me. And if you happen to catch one of the songs, go back and listen to it. It's the perfect 45-minute drive into work album because you go through an entire journey. You won't even sense the traffic. And so it's called Hers, Christmas Cancellation and Ninjas vs. Zombies and Ninjas vs. Vampires are all available on Amazon. And you can find those. Ninjas vs. Monsters is on Vudu. The Distanced with a D is on YouTube. I'll be back next year to promote my novel, which
nice
record is the way through.
So you also have a podcast. What's your podcast?
Well, they are both on hiatus right now. There's the track. So first of all, just because I'm on hiatus from making them for a little bit doesn't mean you have to be on hiatus from listening. There are 10 years worth of episodes of the Trek Off podcast, which we still did a few of this year. I think the last one was like 2 months ago. But covering the early episodes are very dirty. They're kind of like what would happen if Kevin Smith made a Star Trek podcast. And then the last like 3 or 4 years it's a little more conventional, but way more thoughtful. And I highly recommend it. If you are more like a one and done, you want to go listen in any order you want. The Totally Super podcast, where we review every superhero movie ever made, me and my friend Arthur. It's been on hiatus for the last 9 months, but I think we have like 80 or 90, not maybe not 80, maybe 70 episodes or something like that up there. But we just review superhero movies. So, nice. So we would love if you came and listened to those too. So look at all the free entertainment I want to give you. There are hundreds of hours and 6 movies. Five, because the Trek Off movie is not available anywhere.
Are you on TikTok?
Five, I'm not on TikTok. I have not broached that subject, but Daniel Ross is on TikTok and you should look him up there. And hey, while I'm promoting shit, look up Ithaca. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Look up Ithaca's amazing. Go see Spider-Man because Marvel needs your money.
they need that.
listen to my podcast. Listen to this podcast. Follow Jonathan Moody. Justin Tim Payne. Who else can they follow? Can they follow, you know, Ben Folds, I guess, Bare Naked Ladies? You know,
think of all the people that we talked about on the show.
This is Ed Sanchez. Oh, the thing I didn't say about him is that not only is he Shepherd, he is in the DC community, he has brought so many people under his wing. And I owe him a personal debt of gratitude. I know Jay and Devin do. There are so many people that do. He brought the indie film community here to life. After Blair Witch came out, everyone's like, oh, I can do it too. And he has fostered that and promoted that and supported that. I've never seen him say no to someone who really needed him. He's just solid ass dude. And you know, he will, like, I will go to my grave thanking that dude for the help that he gave us. So that, there's the thought I want to leave everyone with.
There you go.
Here's my last thought. The world is a tough place right now, guys. We're in a tough place. And wherever you are politically, wherever you are, you know, whatever your race is, whatever your financial situation is, wherever we are, the world just seems like it's falling apart. And I think part of the reason is people have stopped learning to just love stuff. And so when I say I'm a fan, be a fan. Be a fan of stuff. Whatever you're a fan of, be a fan of it and let people know it. Be a nerd about it. If you love, you know, soccer, be a soccer hooligan, buy every jersey. You know, if you love, you know, the Rolling Stones, buy everything they put every, you don't have to buy it, but go, just be enthusiastic about it, because you only have so much time until you die. And between now and then, do as much good as you can for the people around you. Take care of your family as best you can. And then on God's green earth, you got stuff to enjoy. It's here to make you happy. Be happy, like your stuff. And that's what I want to leave you with. If my enthusiasm is annoying, I am so sorry, but it has brought me through some dark ass days. I hope it does for you too. Sorry. That's end of monologue. Sorry.
Sorry. I was going to say it sounds like the writer of Cancel Christmas or Christmas Cancel.
Yeah, he's a shitty actor, though. I think I did way better than that guy. That guy's not very good at all.
You did great. You did great as that guy, and you did great now. And I love that. That was the theme of the movie too. Is just enjoy your life right now. We're in a dark place.
Enjoy your stuff, man. This is not the worst time ever.
This isn't.
Go back to 1942. This is not the worst time ever. Go back to the Dark Ages. This is not the worst time ever. Enjoy your life. Enjoy your stuff. That's all. That's all I got. Enjoy your stuff.
Thank you so much, Justin. And everybody, thank you guys for listening. Justin, hang around for a second so we can chat. And everybody else, thank you so much. Join us next week. In 2 weeks for another episode. Okay. Bye.
Bye.